Yeah, sure. I'm gonna record it though. It's recording.
Fine. Can you kosher stuff for Pesach in a thing that's not necessarily like so sealed in?
Can you clarify?
Like we have like a wok. You know what a wok is? Or like a pan that you fry eggs in.
Okay.
Like it's wide enough that if you drop utensils in there, it's fine.
Wait, I don't understand. It's a pan that you basically put on a stovetop and you could fry on it?
Yeah.
Well, again, we have Hilchos Pesach that we're doing for coronavirus times and Hilchos Pesach in general. So, b'di'eved, if you're frying something, you could be semich that you don't need a Liban Chamer, and a Liban Ka would be good enough. Even if you need Liban Chamer, and Liban Ka, potentially even Hagala would be good enough.
Could you use Hagala with the pan? That's really the question.
What did you say?
Could you use Hagala with that pan?
I didn't hear you. Like, hold on. I can't hear you anymore.
Hold on. Let me put in my fancy schmancy AirPods.
Yeah, now I got you. Yeah, what were you saying? Sorry.
Okay. Could you do a Hagala with that type of pan? It's not closed in on all sides?
Why does it have to... What do you mean by closed in?
It's like an... It's almost a flatbed pan. It's just easy to kosher.
Yeah, so what's the problem?
Okay, cool.
I don't think that would matter. I think you're fine.
Also, if we don't have access to a blowtorch, the Liban Kal is you just pour boiling water on top of it?
No. That's Iri Klavishay. Liban Kal, yeah, so that wouldn't be good enough. If you need Liban Kal for something, then, I mean, it couldn't even be Liban Chamer. Like, you might even be able to get Liban Chamer by just basically, you just put it on top of the stovetop, turn on the fire all the way, and just keep it there until it gets really hot, I don't know, for like 10, 15 minutes, something like that. Or if your oven, you can also just throw it in your oven, turn your oven really hot, like put it on broil or something like that. I don't know. My oven in Butler was really old.
Yeah,
it just had like these knobs. It was nothing fancy. So basically, I think the way to make it as hot as possible was to put it on broil and then maximum temperature, and that would potentially be a Liban Chamer. So that would be fine. You obviously can't. You know, there are some things you might not be able to do that with. Like you really
you have to have the water boil probably, over though.
What'd you say?
You have to have the water boil over the thing, boil over the edges, right?
No. So water is Hagala, not Liban.
Yeah.
So what are you talking? What sort of utensil are you talking about? Is my
question? Oh, I guess I'm confused now.
I'm not sure what you're. So basically, anything that you cook, right? Cooking means with water, right? So then you do Irui. Then you can do Hagala, right?
Anything like utensils. If I want to catch utensils.
Utensils or pots, right? You boil pasta. You make pasta in a pot, right? That's with water. So those things you can use Hagala on. Yeah. The only time you need you need the water to be overflowing from the pot is if you're kashering that. That's the pot that you're kashering. If you're kashering a different pot in the bigger pot, then the water doesn't need to be overflowing. You just need to have a lot of water in there, enough to, you know.
Can you do Hagala on wooden spoons?
Okay, I'm not so submergent. No, because we don't really. Whoa.
Yeah, what Judah said. You can't kasher wood.
Sorry, I didn't know Rachel joined.
Yeah. You can't, Rachel, basically you can't kasher wood. What you might be able to get away with, and again, I wouldn't say this any other year. This is specifically this year if you don't have any other option and this is what you're stuck with. If it's like a wooden spoon that you never used on the actual fire, like on a pot that's on the actual fire, right? Like maybe it's like a serving dish for salads or something like that. So then it was only ever used for cold. So then you might have better, you could probably just like wash it and then use it on Pesach. But you can't kosher that. It's wood.
Okay. No, I was talking about like my main mixing things for pots is wooden spoons.
Yeah, so that's probably a little bit more of a problem. I wouldn't use that. Even Shasat Chak, I wouldn't use that. Okay, so you want any other
pans? I could just stick in the oven, right?
Yeah, or just turn your stovetop on. But sticking in the oven is probably better.
Okay. Yeah, I have a bit of a problem because I ran out of gas.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, so just throw it in the just throw it in the oven. That's probably better.
Hold on, you can just turn. You can that would be the Liban Kal. Just turn your stovetop on.
So it could potentially even be a Liban Chamer, right? In general, people that like you know everybody else in the world when they're cleaning for Pesach, right? They put their oven on self clean, and that's a Liban Chamer, and we can use the oven for Pesach, yeah. Right? I don't know. Like the problem with the ovens in Israel is self clean gets really hot. I don't know if those ovens that we had get hot enough to be considered a Liban Chamer. So maybe we should be a little bit more machmir and assume it's a Liban Kal. So maybe the best thing, in general for Liban Chamer, you don't have to clean anything. Just throw it in and just turn on the Liban Chamer. That's good enough. But maybe we should be a little bit more careful. We should clean the pots out well or the pans out well and then put them in the oven, not use them for 24 hours, then put them in the oven and use the Liban Kal and assume that it's just a Liban Kal.
Can I ask something?
Okay.
What do you say? Rachel, you had something? Yes, no?
What's the question?
Yes, you told us how to kosher microwaves for Pesach, but in my house, we, for some reason, hold that you can't kosher microwaves for Pesach.
So the problem with kashering microwave is the plate that you put in the microwave. That's the main problem.
Okay.
So the rest of the... So the microwave itself, you can pretty much kasher just by putting a cup in there, fill up with water, and leave it in until the microwave gets full of steam, right? That probably takes a good, I don't know, 5-10 minutes or something like that, right? The problem, though, is that if there's glass in the microwave, that glass plate, Ashkenazim generally don't kasher glass for Pesach.
Now, but if you and we are koshering things, we could this year.
So even if we are koshering things is one level. Koshering glass is like another level. But even so, I still think that this year, like you know, we have a shasatchak, and you don't have if you you need the microwave, you don't have a stovetop, I guess, because your stovetop isn't working. So you could be samech on koshering the glass, and you can kosher it. You can just throw it in a boiling pot of water or something like that. Or actually even maybe pouring water on it might even be good enough. But that's what I would say you could do that, especially for this year. But otherwise, I mean, best case, if you can, find, I don't know what material you would use for this, but find something to cover the glass plate. That's best case scenario. Like that you could even use regularly. That wouldn't be a problem.
Got it.
But I don't know what that material would be. I think that would ruin the microwave, potentially ruin the turning function of that plate, and it might not work as well.
Yeah.
Okay, so you want to get on with what we're actually going to do today. So Rachel, this one's for you. I was going to do the Nitziv on the Agadah. Okay, so basically we had a bunch of different on the Agadah, so I'm going to do a bunch of short, basically go through a whole bunch of short different ideas throughout the Agadah. I basically am only using the Nitziv for this, so that's why I'm calling this Nitziv on the Agadah. I guess that makes sense. Okay, so in general, when you read the Perish of the Nitziv generally has a certain theme, and that's what he builds on throughout his throughout his whatever he's talking about throughout his Perish. He definitely does this in his Perish on Chumash. He does this all the time. Like you can't really appreciate the Perish of the Nitziv unless you start from the beginning. It definitely includes the introduction and go through the entire sefer using the Nitziv. With the Agada, he does this a little bit, not to the same level, but definitely there are themes that come up. So his classical theme, which is not any big chiddush, is just that the purpose of reading the Haggadah one day a year is just to really illustrate the Hashem's basically hand in our day to day life. Right, this is really showing how He's involved with everything that with our lives, with everything that's going on, and how He really cares about our participation in everything. So, I'll just start from the beginning and work my way down. So for karpas, right? So we have this idea here that we wash hands. Now it's interesting that we're washing hands by karpas because, in general, the reason to wash hands when you eat vegetables, it's a chumra that we generally don't pass in. Like nowadays, anyone can wash any vegetable or fruit and just start eating it without a problem. But we are still, but we are specifically makbid by the Leil HaSeder. So classical answer for these sort of things, whenever there's anything different, is that the reason why we do it is because we want the kids to ask, right? The whole point of the Seder is you want participation of the children. So we do weird things in order to get the children to ask. The Nitzin doesn't like that idea. He seems to think that we don't add random things to the Seder to get kids to ask, which I thought was a little bit of a novel idea. In general, I think the attitude is that we do random things to get kids to ask. But the Nitziv has this idea. He doesn't like the concept of us just adding things, off the top of our head. So he gives the reason that specifically wash is because during the Seder, we're basically copying what they used to do during the times of the Beis HaMikdash, when they did have a Karban Pesach. And so during the times of the Beis HaMikdash, people were more makbid on Tumat Tara, and therefore they would wash their hands whenever they would eat any wet vegetables or fruit. So that's why we specifically wash our hands in Lala Seder, because the Seder was Nikva during times of Beis HaMikdash. So we too are following that model that they did then. So even though we don't pass them like it, since they would wash, we also wash. It gives the same reason for why we wear a kittel, because the kittel was not that there's anything significant about a kittel that we wear on Yom Kippur, that we wear when we get married. It's significant because it's a white beged. And apparently when they would eat, they would put on what's it called? The tishbekesha, right? And it would be this white white coat or whatever it was. And that's what they put on whenever they would eat important meals. So for let us say that we put on a white beged. It happens to be the white beged that most people have is a kittel. The white beged that we have might be lab coats, but whatever, that's a different point. The Rav Salvitcher points out that based off this reason, it does apparently some people have this minhag that only the Baal HaBayis, the one actually leading the Seder, wears a kittel. According to this reason, that doesn't necessarily make sense. Everyone who is eating from the Karban Pesach should be wearing this white coat. So everyone should be, so it's not just something that's unique to the Baal HaBayis. Okay, moving on. The reason why he points out that we... So again, Rich, I'm going to tell you the same reason I told you, I think, last time we were talking about Haseba. It's girls, I mean, I guess they could, but I don't think it was ever... The point is we're copying what they used to do back then. So I assume that women weren't wearing a special garment to eat. I think it was just the men that were wearing the special garment to eat. So there's nothing, you're not copying anything. So there's no real reason to wear that. I mean, the kittel definitely would probably be a problem with begging ish. But if you had like a white coat or something like that and you really want to wear it, I don't know if you really want to, I guess. You look a little weird. Looking weird is weird, no? So I don't know, but there's definitely no reason to. now the notable exception to this idea that what we're doing here is copying what they used to do during the Beis HaMikdash is Halach Manya, right? This is a piece that's being added later on, right? We can obviously tell by the fact that it's not written in Hebrew, it's written in Aramaic. So one of the reasons, obviously, classically given for Halach Manya being said in Aramaic is because it's an invitation, and most people didn't speak Hebrew, so if you give an invitation in a language that people don't understand, it's a little bit of a meaningless offer. So we specifically say Halach Manya in Aramaic. And the Tziv's idea is that Halach Manya is something that's added later, it's added in Bavel. So back when they had the Beis HaMikdash, when the Beis HaMikdash was around, it didn't make any sense to say Halach Manya. You can't invite people to Lala Seder when you have a Karban Pesach, because everyone that's eating from the Karban Pesach has to have already, you know, joined the Chabura of Karban Pesach before the Seder. You can't just show up and start eating from someone else's Karban Pesach. So this invitation is something that only makes sense once they get to Bavel and there is no Beis HaMikdash anymore. Now they can randomly invite people off the street to join the Seder. So we're taking advantage, this is like the notable exception here, is that we're taking advantage that we're now in different times and we have this opportunity to be able to invite people off the street. Okay, I'm going to move on in the Agada here. So later on, we're talking about V'ilu Atzi HaKadosh Baruch Hu Sabaseinu Mimitzrayim, right? It sounds like if Hashem, right, the Baal Agada makes it sound like if Hashem didn't take us out of Mitzrayim, to this day, we would still be slaves to Mitzrayim. So this is the going back to the original, the theme of the Nitziv over here, that everything that's happening is to show how Hashem has interest in the Jews' day-to-day life. Is his point is that in general, the reason why powerful governments lose their power and why, you know, power shifts from one country to the other is all because of whatever it is that the Jews are doing during that time, right? The Jews are in one country, they need to be able to get to another country, they did something bad, they have to get thrown out, whatever you want to say. it's all basically revolving around the Jews. So the only reason why Mitzrayim would lose power is because they weren't nice to the Jews. So they end up losing powers and it goes elsewhere. But if the Jews never got their special status, they never got taken out of Mitzrayim, they never got the Torah, they never got everything that makes them unique, so then there would be no reason for governments to change power. So then it's true that if Hashem never took the Jews out of Mitzrayim, Mitzrayim would still be the most powerful country in the world, and we would still be slaves to that country because nothing ever changed. Status quo remained. The next part of the Gada, he talks about, right, so there's a certain order here. So Halach Manya, we're inviting everybody to join. Next, you want to say, okay, what are we doing here, right? And then we talk about, we say the Manishtana, right? We ask the questions and we tell everybody, listen, the problem here is that we were Avadim, and if Hashem hadn't taken us out. And then the Baal Gada tells us, listen, who has to be involved in this mitzvah? So the first thing is the Baal Gada mentions is even Kulanu Chachamim, right? Everyone knows everything. We're all Tamid Chachamim. We're all geniuses. We know everything that there is to know. We still would have a mitzvah. And that is, and it's points out, it's an important idea that the original mitzvah is to teach everybody about the Seder, about the mitzvahs that you have to do on the Seder, about the fact that you have to have Sipul Yetzias Mitzvayim. And the original mitzvah could potentially have been mandatory for people that just didn't know or needed the reminder. The Talmidei Chacham that know everything already, they, even though the Tama mitzvah is gone for them, that doesn't mean they are patur from the mitzvah itself, right? You can't start dashening Tamei mitzvahs and then get rid of mitzvahs because you don't think the reason applies anymore. Once it's a mitzvah deraisa, we keep the mitzvah because Hashem told us to keep the mitzvah, not because of whatever the reason was behind that mitzvah. So even if the reason doesn't apply to you, you still have to be mekayim this mitzvah. And that's why he specifically signals out these Kulanu Chachamim. And so our classic example of Kulanu Chachamim is our people in Bnei Brak. And when we're talking about the people of Bnei Brak, we say, right? The Baal Gada says, right? I don't have the text in front of me. But he says, and then he says, and then we talk about the Seder of Bnei Brak. So what he's telling us, so first of all, it's not exactly clear what it means, right? Why, in general, when you do a mitzvah, you're a chayv in the mitzvah, and not more than a mitzvah. If I decide to sit in the sukkah on the ninth day, 3 days after sukkah is over, I haven't accomplished anything. And I potentially, if I'm doing it for mitzvah sukkah, I am ovel b'fussi. So it's in general, it's actually usher. It's not kol amal b'arizim mishubach. So the Nitziv has this idea that what happens by Leila Seder is two things. One is I have one chiv of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. That chiv I'm accomplishing at night until either Chatzos or until Alayis HaShachar. It's on to Machlokes in the Gemara, which point the chiv lasts until. But after that, there still is some sort. You're still accomplishing something, maybe some sort of zechira, or something along those lines. The chira is what we're generally doing when we say like Kriya Shema or something like that. There is this other concept of saying something that involves the Seder. So then we discuss the Seder B'nei Brak, where we mention actually the Tanaim in B'nei Brak are both people that say that chiyuv is either until Chatzot or the chiyuv is until Alos, and they go until they continue their Seder until Sobzman Kriya Shema. Right, so their Seder, according to all the Shitas, went above and beyond the time that they needed to do. So that's really illustrating the fact that even though A, these are Chachamim, B, this is past the time that you are actually Mechoyev in the Mitzvah, still they were continued to be involved in this idea of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. So I want to just take, I'm going to go a little bit off the Nitziv right now. I just want to talk about the Seder B'nei Brak a little bit. First of all, why is everybody hanging out at Rabbi Akiva's house? Right, he's not the Nasi. Bnei Brak is, on the side there, in the middle of nowhere. Right? What's going on? Why is everybody at Bnei Brak? So, there seems to be this interesting idea that this Seder Bnei Brak, which I assume you already heard this one because you're smiling. The Seder Bnei Brak is after Churban Bayis, right? So what happens is after Churban Bayis, before the Beis Hamikdash gets destroyed, everyone knows what Pesach is about. It's about the carbon Pesach. Now nobody has any idea what to do anymore. There's no Karban Pesach. What is Pesach about? So everyone goes to the most hopeful guy in the room, and that's Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva is the one who classically sees foxes coming out of the Beis Hamikdash, and he starts laughing while everyone else is crying. And he's the man that can always see the light, even in the, you know, darkest of times, so to say, right? So the, everybody goes to him to try to give them support throughout this episode. So then, what's also interesting with Rabbi Akiva is Rabbi Gamliel is clearly still doing Hilchos Pesach, right? Because in his Seder, he's talking about Pesach Batzamar, you have to be masked these three things, right? It seems like there are two different Sdalim going on here, whatever Rabbi Gamliel was doing and what Rabbi Akiva is doing. So it seems like Rabbi Gamliel is still involved with Hilchos Pesach, and Rabbi Akiva maybe is involved more with Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, more with, okay, listen, we don't have the Karban Pesach anymore, so let's focus more on the Matzah. Let's talk about this whole story about what happened when they were leaving. So there's a couple of interesting points on that also. So the Gra changes the Girsa, because the Girsa, the Tosefta says, it sounds like they were talking about Hilchos Pesach. So because it says they're dealing with the Dinim of Pesach or something like that, so he changes the Girsa to say they were talking about Tzipul Yetzias Mitzrayim. So A, that fits in a little bit better with this argument that what Rabbi Akiva is doing is really, you know, just showing the whole Sipu. So he's, the Gra changes the Gilsa to fits in nicely with that shot. It's also interesting that what could be going on here is that they're dealing with when everyone is sitting by the Lela Seder, well, now they're dealing with Sipu Yetzias Mitzrayim, right? Rabbi Akiva's being mechadesh is maybe this novel idea that since Karban Pesach is not around, so now what we're going to focus more on is Sipu Yetzias Mitzrayim. But what ends up happening is that after Chatzot, it could be there's no Chiv anymore. Or it could be that the Chiv of Sipu Yetzias Mitzrayim is specifically when there's Matzah and Marer Munachim Lefanecha, right? The Matzah and Marer here by the Seder. I have to finish my Chatzot because I'm have to finish my Afikam Chatzos, which means I already ate everything. So now what am I going to do after Chatzos? Now that all the Sipur part of the story is over, I'm going to switch it to Hilchos Pesach. So really we're doing both. Even though we don't have the Karban Pesach anymore, I'll switch after Chatzos to then spend the rest of the night talking about Hilchos Pesach. And that's potentially what they were doing from midnight until Sosman Kriyat Shema. There is learning Hilchos Pesach, there is still the concept of being involved in Yetzias Mitzrayim. It's just a slightly different manifestation of it, right? The first half of the night will focus on the storytelling, and the second half of the night we'll focus on the halachas. Rav Soloveitchik has this idea, which is a classical Rav Soloveitchik idea, which is the entire night you really should be doing Hilchos Pesach, because when you learn the halachas, you come to really appreciate the story. Okay, fine, I'm going to leave that aside. But this at least is an Nitziv idea that I think we can read it into the Nitziv. He doesn't say it explicitly, but I think at least you can read it into the Nitziv that the first half of the night we're doing Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim and the second half of the night we're doing Hilchos Pesach. Okay, so now let's move on in the Seder. So again, the idea of why the Baal Haggadah here starts off Bignus and ends off with Shvach, right? Arami Avidavi, we were Avidavi Dezara, and then only afterwards did we come out of Mitzrayim and get the Torah. So the reason why we start off with Gnus is to really illustrate the purpose of going to Mitzrayim, right? Because what does it mean that the fact that we're thanking Hashem for going to Mitzrayim, for taking us out of Mitzrayim, is a little weird. He's the one who told us to go to Mitzrayim. Why are we thanking him for getting us out of the trouble that he got us into? We should be, you know, I guess maybe we could thank him eventually, but we should probably be more upset than happy by the fact that he put us in that situation in the first place. So the Tziv has this idea that the whole point of starting out with Gnos is to illustrate that if we would have stayed in Eretz Yisrael the way we were going to be Oved Avodah Zarah, right? When we were there originally, we were Oved Avodah Zarah. True, Yaakov wasn't Oved Avodah Zarah, Abraham wasn't Oved Avodah Zarah, Yitzhak wasn't Oved Avodah Zarah, but like, you know, up at least until Yaakov, 50% of the kids are going to be Oved Avodah Zarah, right? Our chances weren't all that great if we would have stayed in Israel. So Hashem specifically went and took us out of Eretz Yisrael, brought us down to Mitzrayim to, I guess, fine-tune us, clean us up, whatever you want to call it, so that when we go back and we get the Torah, now we really will be focused and wouldn't get confused and wouldn't be doing Avodah Zarah and really would have the special status as Am HaNivcha. Now, the next part of the Haggadah starts off with the Gnos, in the middle there talks about the Rami Ovid Avi, right? So the idea, so it's interesting that we're starting off with love, and it's really some of the same point. Originally, right, the whole idea is that we have to go through some sort of galus, and that will fine-tune us. With Lavan, we're getting confused, because Lavan was really part of the family, right? He's the father of half the wives here. with Lavan, it was very hard to make this differentiation between us and them. Right? With Lavan, it was very difficult to know that, listen, we're different than they are. It was all, you know, a little bit more mixed together. So therefore, the Baal Gadol tells us, listen, Lavan wasn't a good option. So we then had to go by Yerim Mitzrayim, Arami Ovid Abi, Arami being Lavan. Lavan wasn't, being at Lavan wasn't going to accomplish what we needed, so we had to go to a different Galus. And therefore, we moved out to Mitzrayim, where there was clearly this distinction between Jews and Mitzrayim. So the Baal Gadol then dashens the word Vayerim Mitzrayim, right? So he says it's a Nusar Pi Adibo. Right, he's learning out from the fact that it says Vayere, that he was forced to go down. It's interesting a little bit that he assumes that it's forced to go down. Generally, Israel's higher up, so when you're going to other countries, you're going down. There's no reason to assume there's a double meaning. So he just has this interesting idea that Yaakov was in Emek Chevron. Emek Chevron is lower down than Mitzrayim. So when you're going down to Mitzrayim, you're not actually going down, you're going up because he was lower. So he is able to dash in that it was a Nusa Pia Dibur. I didn't really want to go. Judah, if you have to go, don't worry about it. Next, it's interesting, Lashon, because the Lashon is Vayiru Otanu, right? Not Vayiru Lanu. In general, if Vayira, sorry. Instead of saying Vayira Lanu, it says Vayiru Oisanu. It sounds like they corrupted us. So it seems like when Mitzrayim caught themselves, dug their own grave. The Mitzrayim corrupted, it's that the problem here is not that they made us evil and therefore, they decided to put us, the problem was not that they caused hardship for us and then decided to make us into slaves. The problem was they corrupted us to the point where they couldn't trust us anymore, because now we were, you know, I guess people that you couldn't really trust. So they were afraid that if anyone would come attack them, we would join. So then they had dug their own grave, so to speak. They're the ones who made the Jews people that were untrustworthy. And so then the Mitzrayim had to go and make us slaves. So that in case if anybody would ever revolt, the Jews, if any army would ever attack, the Jews wouldn't revolt against them. Because they were slaves, they wouldn't have to worry about them killing them off. So it's really the Mitzrayim's own fault that this ended up happening, that they ended up getting scared. A couple more points. First of all, it says that after Vayibay Mimahem, right, the Melech Mitzrayim dies, and then we start crying out to Hashem. So what is the connection between him dying and us being able to cry to Hashem? So the Tziv has this, I know classically there's a couple of different ideas about this. The Tziv's idea, though, is that once the Paro died, so everyone was involved in the funeral arrangements. Since everybody was involved in funeral arrangements and figuring out what to do and how to, you know, mourning, so the Jews had a day off. So the Jews had the opportunity to get together in Shul and be able to daven together. So now that they had this opportunity, they were able to focus on tefillah. And then because they were davening together as a tzibur kulam biyachad, so then Hashem really listened to their tefillahs and went and took them out of Mitzrayim. Another interesting lesson in the Agadah here is that he says, "Ra'isi es ani ami b'Mitzrayim." Right? It seems to be that Hashem sees the lashon seems to be that he's focusing on his nation in Mitzrayim. So it's interesting. Hashem has one nation, right? We're one chosen people. What is this? Why is it ani b'Mitzrayim? It doesn't have a nation anywhere else. So it seems this is again going back to the general concept here of the Mitzrayim ruining the Jews, and if he just gets them out. Hashem just gets them out, the Jews are on a different level, is that the reason why the Jews were, I guess, as corrupt as, maybe not as great as they could have been when they were in Mitzrayim, is because they were in Mitzrayim, because of Lachat Mitzrayim, because of the pressure of Mitzrayim. So Hashem sees if he just takes us out of that pressure cooker, that area, we would be that much greater. So he saw the potential of the Jews, and because of the potential that he saw, that's why he took them out of Mitzrayim. That's the idea of focusing on the nation in Mitzrayim, was specifically because they were in Mitzrayim, that they had this low level. Another idea is biat, right? The Gada says biat chazaka zu devil, and then afterwards it lists the ten makas. So why is devil getting mentioned twice? So the Tzivs argues that this devil is not the devil of the esamakas. Esamakas had one sort of devil. This devil was the devil that during makas choshech, during some of the other makas, the Jews that didn't want to go out. That were not, I guess, maybe not reach this potential, or didn't want to be saved or weren't supposed to be saved, they were getting killed out during this devil. So we're sort of, Hashem's Yad Chazakah is basically like taking the good and leaving the bad. He's just, you know, he's wiping out the parts of the Jews that maybe shouldn't have been taken out for whatever reason. Apparently part of this, at least according to the Nitziv, the idea was that a bunch of the slaves, since they were slaves to the country, they weren't necessarily slaves to individual people. Some of the slaves worked directly for Paro. The slaves that worked directly for Paro apparently were able to make a lot of money and were living actually pretty good lives. They were living in the palace. They were doing quite well. They had no interest in leaving. It's somewhat telling that, you know, the people that didn't have an interest in living the galus, they're the ones that are getting killed off and not worthy of being saved. You have to have a yearning to want to be saved, to want to reach your full potential. Oh, and I'm going to skip the whole Dalet Banim thing. I want to go straight to a couple of ideas just on Ilu Hotzianu for Dayenu. So first of all, the Ilu Kalalanu Hotayam, right? We seem to have this idea that there's something, we're thanking Hashem not just for splitting Yamsu for us, but also when he does it, he doesn't do the bare necessities, but he makes it a comfortable experience, right? Those walls went up nicely. There was a nice solid floor. Right, it was a nice experience walking through. Even when Hashem's saving us, it's not just basic needs that He's giving us, but also He's giving us a certain standard of living, which we're appreciating that point. Another somewhat similar idea is we're also thanking Hashem that He gave us enough to last in the desert for 40 years. Right, originally the Jews are only going to be in the desert for a couple of months, however long it takes to walk from Mitzrayim to Israel. Can't imagine it takes that long, right? They do the Avera, so then they end up. So then they end up having to stay for 40 years. So we're thanking Hashem for the fact that He gives us enough to be able to last for those 40 years to illustrate that even when we're, not only when we go into a midbar with not enough clothes to last for that long, but even when anytime we go into Galut, anytime we're in Galut, Hashem is always there to protect us, to give us what it is that we need, you know, as long as we daven for it, etc. But that's really illustrating that idea that Hashem is there for us no matter what. And then the next, a couple later on, is if He just brought us to Har Sinai and didn't really give us the Torah. So the idea here is, like, we sort of have this switch. We went from away from, right, in that Agadah, the first half of the Agadah is going away from negative, and the second half is really going towards positive, right? First, we're getting away from slavery, from being idol worshippers, etc., etc., and then we're becoming Hamanivcha. So the first one of those is Hashem's giving us the Torah. Now that we have the Torah, we can learn how to think from like Hashem's point of view, right? We have the tools to now be able to understand what Hashem's about. And then the next one, you go into Eretz Yisrael. Once you're in Eretz Yisrael, right there is where you have Amunah and Hashkacha to a point where you don't have an Echutz La'aretz. So you really are transitioning over. You're getting not just the point of view, but also a closer relationship. And then an even closer relationship is when we actually get to build the Beis HaMikdash, right? And we get to see Hashem up close and personal 3 times a year. You have to be Oleh Regel, and that's where you really get that that experience from. So that's really what those three Dayenus are emphasizing. It's bringing us closer and closer to Hashem as we move away from slavery into the positive. Just another point going back to the original idea, which was once we get past the Enu, right? We talked about the matzah, the mar. So we say matzah zu, right? So again, we're illustrating the fact that now that there's no Korban Pesach anymore, this Seder is really revolving around this matzah, right? So before we had Korban Pesach, and now we have matzah. So we specifically emphasize matzah zu shanu achim. That's the idea. That's what the Seder is really revolving around. And just one final point, which I thought was a nice idea to end off on, which is right. It's the same concept as b'shuli nivra olam, right? The Hashem, you should every generation, right? You should see not that you should see yourself as if you went out of slavery. People always have this problem: how am I supposed to imagine that I went out of slavery? They see Tim's idea is not so much that I have to imagine that I went out of slavery, but I have to imagine that the whole reason why Hashem took the Jews out was for me. Since it was for me, that means I've been given this great opportunity to accomplish all that much. I should really, you know, do something with it. Hashem did all these great miracles for me. Make sure, you know, I really accomplished something with my life. Take advantage of the fact that I'm free. Take advantage of the fact that I was given the Torah, that I was given Eretz Yisrael, that I was at least at one point had the Beis HaMikdash, hopefully get it again soon. But that I really have all these tools, and now I should really use them to the best of my ability and accomplish as much as I could.